The focus here, of course, in Hebrews 11 is faith produces certainty that we cannot see. And we have many Old Testament saints we're going to look at as examples of that. Yet, nevertheless, the emphasis here on the writer of Hebrews is even though they demonstrated faith, they departed without seeing the hope which we today enjoy. And so we're going to look at those passages, and then at the end wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about the countdown to Christmas. We've been going through a series in the church from waiting. This week was wonder. Next week is worship. And last week in the waiting, it was the sort of the countdown to Christmas. Even today under the wonder section, Jared Stevens talked about one of the messianic prophecies. So Suzanne suggested, why don't we do that? And I said, well, we've sort of covered that before. He says, well, it's worth going over again. And since we have so many new people in the class, we'll do that in the last half of our section. But let's do the canter to Hebrews 11. And we'll look at the first three verses. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the people of old received their commendation. By faith we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. And so here the writer of Hebrews is reminding us that in some respects faith is different. Our eyesight helps us to actually have a conviction about the things in our physical world. But faith gives us that same kind of conviction for the unseen world. Matter of fact, Pastor Graham's latest book is called Unseen, and it's all about this spiritual battle that is taking place. And here, the writer of Hebrews reminds us that faith is what enabled the heroes of the Old Testament to receive a good standing before God. It really helps answer one of the questions. One of those questions you get from time to time, apart from what about those who have not heard, or what about those who cannot believe, is another one that you get sometimes about salvation is, what about those people before Christ? They didn't know Christ. I mean, how could they believe in Christ because he wasn't there? And we, I think, have a very good answer here in Hebrews 11. And the idea that believing that God created the world, obviously it involves a leap of faith, but it's based upon very firm evidence that we've talked about in this class and as we did a series with the Institute for Creation Research. It points, of course, to this unseen power, and faith looks not just to the creation, but also the consummation. So this idea of faith not only looks to the past in the creation, but looks to the future in terms of the culmination, the new heavens and the new earth. And so now we're going to make our way through some of the different examples that are used in what is called the Hebrews Hall of Faith. Verses 4 to 7. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gift, and through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death, and he was not found because God had taken him. Now, before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please him, for whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And by faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear, constructed an ark for the saving of his household. And by this, he condemned the world and became the heir of righteousness that comes by faith. And so we look at three different individuals leading up to the flood as examples of that. And we see that, first of all, Genesis, really, if you go back and look at that, never really answers the question why Abel's offering was more acceptable than Cain's. We just read that, says that it was. Of course, Cain, out of unrighteous anger, eventually kills Abel. But we never really understand that. And here, interestingly enough, verse 4 answers that question, explains that Abel showed faith and had an obedient attitude, and that is why his was most acceptable. And so the work of Cain is evil, the work of Abel's was righteousness. So then it takes us from Cain and Abel to Enoch. It says that he walked with God, and if you're taking some notes, you might put down Genesis 5:24, that's where that reference is, and was no more. And so we see that two things happen. Number one, he was released from death due to his faith. Some individuals, in this particular case, Enoch, never had to face death. It looks ahead to another one as well. And then, second of all, before his release, he had lived a life pleasing to God, and so he was living a life of righteousness in a world of And that's, of course, set up now for Noah as well. And here it talks about fellowship with God cannot exist without faith, because it says, first, we must believe that he exists, and second, that God rewards those who earnestly seek him. Which is also another one of those answers. What about those who have not heard? Well, if those are seeking the Lord, God will provide revelation to them as well. And then we go back to Noah. Noah, verses, our chapters 6 to 9 in Genesis, show faith by a specific response. And here, the writer of Hebrews is talking about the fact that faith is what is unseen. Well, if you think about it, Noah's demonstrated that faith. Imagine living in a world where you've never seen a flood, and you really had never seen rain. I mean, because it says that it just came up from the midst of the ground. Some people say that maybe the water vapor canopy provided that. So imagine living in a world where you've never seen rain, you've never seen a flood, and you're supposed to build this huge ark. And as they are building a replica of that ark in Kentucky, Answers in Genesis, you're beginning to realize how big it is. The ark would be bigger than this room, to put it mildly. Okay, so you're going to imagine building something that big for a flood you've never seen because of rain that you had never seen. Does that have to exercise some kind of faith? And I think it gives you an idea. And he took the warning to heart, built an ark, saved his family, and of course then provided a visible and physical evidence that indeed Noah believed. And so we see that as well. Then from verses 8 and following, we have Abraham and the patriarchs. Verse 8. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. And by faith, Sarah herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised. And so here now we see a little bit more about the patriarchs. Let me continue on. Might as well pick up the rest part of that. Therefore, from one man, as him as good as dead, were born descendants, as many of the stars of heaven, as many of the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. And by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob died and blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. And by faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. And so we have a number of stories here of the patriarchs, and once again we see how they exercise faith. Abraham's faith, of course, shines very brightly in this dark age in which he lives. And Paul, interestingly enough, you know, I put this down maybe for your quiet time this week. Go to Romans chapter 4 this week and look that Paul spent an entire chapter in the book of Romans talking about Abraham. And so we pick that up here as well. And how important is Abraham? Well, 2 billion Christians have traced their faith back to Abraham. 1.5 billion Muslims trace their faith back to Abraham. And millions, about 18 million Jews trace their heritage back to Abraham. How important indeed was that? And then it gives us 3 interesting facts in verses 9 and 10 about Abraham's faith. First of all, it says that his faith extended to his family. So just as he was faithful, then his faith was extended to his family. Second, it shows really this tenacious faith. Here he was a nomad. I mean, if you had caught Abraham on his trip, you might say, Abraham, where are you going? Not really sure. How do you know when you get there? I'm not really sure about that either. What are you going to do when you get there? Don't know that either. You see that that's really a whole lot of faith in terms of where he was going and what he was doing. But then it talks about a city built not with human hands, but with God's hands. And this is looking not just to a physical city, but it's also looking ahead to a spiritual city, this new heaven and new earth. Then we see that it also talks about the piety of all the patriarchs, verses 13 to 16. These men were living by faith when they died. They did not receive the promise, and they were aliens and wanderers. This is all happening before they have the promised land, if you will, before it is actually solidified later on, although Abraham sojourned in the land for a time. And so again, we see that they were also living by faith, because just as Abraham didn't exactly know the future, neither did they as well. And we see some examples of that. First of all, these verses illustrate the faith that Abraham had when he was willing to sacrifice Isaac on Mount Moriah. And even though Abraham had never seen somebody raised from the dead, this implies that he believed that even if he were to strike Isaac down, that God would raise him from the dead. And that demonstrates the full extent of his faith, to believe that God would raise his son that he killed from the dead. Then we also see that it commends Isaac's faith by blessing both Jacob and Esau. And of course, we see Isaac and Jacob showed faith in recognizing the blessing of the younger son. And then also it even talks us about the faith that Joseph has. When you think about that, he had enough faith because he was sold into captivity and into slavery and all this rest. But the thing that this author of Hebrews picks out is that he was giving directions for his bones to be taken into the promised land. And so maybe in a few weeks I want to do something from this new film called Evidence, Patterns of Evidence, which I think helps us understand a little bit more about Joseph and the Exodus. This new film that's come out, we'll maybe play clips of it and talk a little bit about that, because it's fascinating to show we may actually know where Joseph's place is, where his bones were taken, and that's all coming from some of this new archaeological find. So that gives reality to what we're saying. And then finally, Moses, it describes this. And so let's look at Moses, because he is one of the other principals in this Hebrew Hall of Faith. And in verse 23, we pick that up. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw that the child was beautiful, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. By the way, perhaps one of the most famous verses here in chapter 11. Verse 26. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking forward to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. And so once again, we have some of these things in terms of the faith of Moses. First of all, again, you want to take some notes, you might put down Exodus 2. And here it gives us some of the details of hiding Moses by the parents. And certainly that would be the case. Fills in some of the details. Then the verses also commend the faith of Moses as an adult. And then, of course, it talks about he suffered for the sake of Christ and kept the Passover. Which I think some people would say, well, how did he suffer for Christ? We're going to pick that up in just a minute, because we now need to go to one other verse, verse 29. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do so, were drowned. And so here we now see not only the faith of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses, but now we see the faith of those wandering in Israel. And the nation of Israel displayed faith by, again, journeying across the Red Sea. Again, we have some new archaeological evidence to suggest where that path might have been taken. We'll talk about that in the class in the coming weeks. And again, it illustrates the faith that, again, must have inspired Moses. We talk about Abraham believing that indeed God could raise someone from the dead when he'd never seen anyone. We've talked about Noah believing that there would be a flood when he'd never seen a flood. Can you imagine standing in front of the Red Sea and God telling you, we're going to part this and you're going to walk across here. And as you walk across, dust is going to pop up here. And then after that, we're going to close it back down and we're going to drown all the Egyptians. Right. I mean, that just shows you again the kind of faith that each one of these individuals demonstrated. And that's why the writer of Hebrews actually covers that. Then he moves on to spend a little more time talking about sort of the faith through the history of Israel. And starting in verse 30, follow along with me there. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with a sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. Very long list there, but I'll try to summarize it fairly quickly. Here we again see that faith allowed those who were the great warriors to win battles. How it others, when they were not in power, to suffer and endure persecution. And all, because of faith, anticipated the life beyond. And then it tells us about Joshua encircling Jericho. Again, think about the faith that must have required. What are we going to do? Well, we're not going to actually fight. We're going to encircle seven different times. On the seventh time, we're going around seven times, we're going to blow a horn, and this is going to work. Right. You know, once again, you can exercise the faith. And then, this is why I think it is so encouraging, because just as I shared, when you go to, the Basketball Hall of Fame, you can't relate to these great players. But if they had one individual that's sort of like you, and here, Rahab, that's why, again, in the Hebrews Hall of Fame, we're not just having Abraham and Moses and Noah, we're having people like Rahab the prostitute. He's in that list as well. Pretty amazing. Then it gives us a list, and some of these you may not know. So if you're taking some notes, this would be an assignment for your quiet time this week to learn a little bit more about that. The first is, of course, from the Judges. And we have each one of those. It mentions Gideon, and we have Gideon in Judges 6 through 8. And again, we can relate to this person who doesn't have a great deal of faith. You know, he has to put out a fleece, has to do all sorts of things. He's having difficulty, so I can relate to that. Barak, you may not know him as well, but he was one of the judges. You can see him in Judges 4 to 5. And then we have Samson. I think most everybody knows the story of Samson. And that's in Judges 13 through 16. A mighty warrior, but again, who falls into sin. And then Jephthah in Judges 11 to 12. And so you can see that as the writer of Hebrews is giving some examples, he picks four from the time of the judges. Now, during the time of the judges, everybody did what was right in what? Their own eyes. So we can see even during this really sort of dark period, during the judges, he commends you and gives you at least four individuals that deserve commendation and make their way into the Hebrew Hall of Faith. Then he takes some that you would say definitely belong. You know, this is like when LeBron James and Steph Curry are eventually up, they're going into the Hall of Fame. We know that. David and Sammy, we know they're already going in there, right? You know, we got that figured out a long time ago. David and Samuel and individuals like that. But again, we have them in that same Hall of Faith with individuals that we probably could relate to. That means there's a place for us as well. Then it goes on to even talk about some of the other achievements, conquering kingdoms, establishing justice. And then the very sad part here, it talks about the persecution that Christians or believers faced in the Old Testament because of their faith and persecution. And it talks about beatings, and I certainly think that applies to Jeremiah. But when you saw it in two, it wasn't until this week I was saying, you know, where is that described in the Bible? Well, it actually is not. But in the Old Testament Talmud, and the Mishnah, we put it from the Talmud today, it says that most likely Isaiah was that individual. That's how he died. He was slaughtered too. So these are not direct references to people like Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Isaiah, but they are oblique references that the Jewish believers would have recognized and understood. And so again, we have that faith through history. So let me close it off here, and then we'll get into some of the messianic prophecies. We have the last few verses, verses 39 and following. And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. And here we have just an illustration again that these promises for these individuals that we are talking about, all in the Old Testament, some before the flood, some during the patriarchal period, some during the judges, others that were some of the prophets, these were all individuals looking for the promise, but they only appeared when Christ came on the land, and Christ came to once again fulfill those promises, which we'll talk about in just a minute. So they did not experience that eternal heritage, but they were looking forward to it. And so faith earned them a remarkable reputation, but they did not actually receive that promise until Christ came to earth. And so again, we can see in Hebrews 11, it is kind of a listing of all sorts of people that have made it into the Hebrews Hall of Faith. And the bottom line is, whether they're the great heroes of the faith or people that you would never have figured would end it into that, I think there's a place for us as well. So as we have just a few more minutes, one of the things we thought we would do, especially since Garrett Stevens last week talked about waiting. Waiting, this week wonder, next week worship. Is what about this waiting? And so I want to look at the countdown to Christmas, because this is just a great opportunity once again to remind ourselves of the Christmas season about how indeed God was setting forth, if you will, sort of the divine address so that they would know when to be looking for the Messiah. I'm going to pull most of this from two books, which I would commend to you. Matter of fact, the best book on this is the one on the left. It is written by D. James Kennedy, called Messiah, Prophecies Fulfilled. Outstanding book. And it would be a great book to have around the Christmas season. If you want to read it around the Christmas table or have a devotional on it, outstanding book. And also a newer book by Tim LaHaye called Jesus, in which he has a whole section about these messianic prophecies and a whole section about the comparison between Moses and Jesus, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But let's look at just a few of those prophecies. We have 333 messianic prophecies, and I'll make sure that we don't look at all of them today because all of us want to go to lunch, right? But these are written down from 1400 B.C. to about 400 B.C. We actually have copies in our hands. Those of you that have been to Israel, either with me or with Pastor Graham, if you've gone to the Jerusalem Museum, you actually see them. You can actually see some of these that actually we have in our hands written down before the time of Christ. So you can't have them say, well, these were fulfilled after the fact. 56 specific facts dealing with the coming Messiah, literally fulfilled in his birth, ministry, death, and resurrection. And so I want to look at kind of 16 examples real quickly to just help you illustrate how these prophecies were fulfilled. And they break down into the prophecies of his coming, the prophecies of his ministry, and the prophecies of his victory. The first of his coming, get into this, and as early as Genesis 3, we see a curious prophecy, if you will, one that may not have even necessarily occurred to every Jew, because it says after the fall that the Messiah would come from the seed of a woman and he would come to destroy the work of the devil. Now, actually, when it talks about seed of the woman, this is probably a little bit pause for even a Jewish believer, because he used to talk about the seed of a man. But here they talk about a seed of a woman, which might imply, and we may be reading more into it than was there, that this indeed would talk about a miraculous birth. But it also says that that individual that would come of the seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent. Well, a pretty good idea who the serpent is, because he's described in Genesis 3. And I think this prophecy was fulfilled at the cross, but some people believe that it also finds its final culmination in Revelation chapter 20. And so again, that is the first of these messianic prophecies. Then we have all these prophecies related to the family tree. And like I said, it's sort of like giving a divine address. Imagine you wanted to tell somebody that you wanted them to come to the chapel and come to this class. And so maybe first you'd say, well, it's in the United States. They'd say, well, good, that helps me. That eliminates about 190 other countries. But that narrows it down a little bit, but not a whole lot. And you'd say, well, it's in Texas. Okay, that narrows it down, but it eliminates 49 other states. And then you'd say it's in Plano. Well, that's better because there's a lot of states and there are a lot of cities. And so now I'm down to a city in a state in a country. But still, Plano might not help you a whole lot. And so, well, it's on Parker Boulevard. Well, that's a little better, but Park Boulevard goes down there for miles and a little bit this way. So, well, that narrows it down a whole lot more. And then you would begin to say, well, it's a Crested Way. And you'd say, well, that helps. But you know, all of us know that sometimes when somebody said, I'll meet you at Crestonwood, you go, which room, right? You know, there are so many rooms here, so you'd have to say it's in the chapel. And eventually you can narrow it down. Likewise, you see the same thing. Because here we see that the Messiah would come first from the line of Shem. Who was Shem? Well, after Noah, son set off the ark, you have Ham, Shem, and Japheth. So that eliminates two-thirds of the people. Then it says Abraham. Well, that narrows it down quite a bit because there are all sorts of other groups around there. The Canaanites, the Phoenicians, all sorts of others, the Egyptians. So, okay, that narrows it down. Then Abraham, and then Isaac. Well, he had at least two sons, Isaac and what? Ishmael, so that eliminates another one. Then Jacob, well, you have Jacob and Esau, eliminates some more. By the time you get to the tribes, Judah, okay, that eliminates 11 twelfths, doesn't it? Kind of like eliminating from the country to the state, to the city, to the street, same kind of thing. Then tribe of Benjamin, and finally the lineage of David. And so it narrows it down. And this is, I think, important because both Luke and Matthew give us the genealogies and illustrate again where the Messiah came. The third, and Jarrett Stevens already mentioned this today in the message, is that in Micah 5:2 it says that the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. And I like how he presented that. You know, Jesus did not come to the center of political power, Rome. Jesus did not come to the center of intellectual belief, maybe Athens. Or you could maybe say Alexander, you pick Athens. So, did not even come to the Jewish leaders, Jerusalem, but to Bethlehem. Matter of fact, it says Bethlehem Ephrathah because there were actually two Bethlehems. And if you go back and look in the Old Testament, when they give a list of the cities, Bethlehem's not mentioned. That's how insignificant it is. It's like Roanoke, or it's like Garland, or it's like, I'm trying to think of even a smaller town. It's like Frisco, or none of that work anymore because these are big towns now. But, you know, something like that. And so as a result, we begin to see how insignificant that was. But again, fulfilled, we see in Matthew 2 and Matthew chapter Luke as well. Then we have, of course, the prophecy we just talked about here. The prophecy that is also found in Isaiah chapter 7 about the fact that, behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. And so we can begin to see how these are beginning to narrow down in very significant ways. A couple of those prophecies, perhaps at the time, did not seem like messianic prophecies. And one of those is an odd comment that Jeremiah gives in Jeremiah chapter 31 about Rachel weeping. Now, in the context, it was sort of a poetic mode of expression. Who was Rachel? Well, Rachel was the wife of Jacob. And so that was kind of the idea of a symbolic figure of Israel conveyed to say, in a sense, this is what happens when the Babylonians took the southern kingdom into exile and they were brought there and the sorrow for the children taken into captivity. But Matthew says, no, this was a prophecy also talking about this, and it was literally fulfilled when Herod ordered that all children would be killed under the age of two, which Jarrett Stevens just mentioned again today. Another one which probably would have been very strange at the time and may not have even been considered a messianic prophecy, we find in the book of Hosea. And this is the idea of Egypt. And it said the Messiah would be called out of Egypt. I think any Jewish writer at the time, any Jewish reader at the time, any Jewish scholar at the time, probably would think all that really means is that because the nation of Israel came out of Egypt, so also the Messiah comes out of Egypt. But Matthew says, no, actually, this is a fulfillment of where, indeed, as Jared Stevens shared with us this morning, the angel warns Joseph and Mary to flee from Bethlehem and to go to Egypt. And so then the young child, in a sense, comes out of Egypt when they come back to Nazareth. And that was, again, literally fulfilled as well. Those are just a few of the prophecies of his coming. Let's briefly look at some of the prophecies of his ministry. And the first is, you can see both in the book of Isaiah and in the book of Malachi, the idea that there would be a forerunner to the Messiah. And as Jared Stevens last couple of weeks has talked about, there is 400 years of silence. There's no prophet. There is nothing. And then all of a sudden, a prophet shows up on the scene, John the Baptist. And he is here to prepare the way. And we see those fulfilled in Matthew 11 and Luke 3. And again, that prophetic voice had been eliminated, but then he was now a Nazarite who was a special witness who was actually a forerunner for Jesus. Then we have a whole section about how the Messiah will indeed be a prophet like Moses. And you see this in Deuteronomy 18. I found that this is a fairly effective way to actually witness to Jewish people. Because Jewish people, especially if they're Orthodox Jews, and I know Jews for Jesus and one for Israel and others use this technique, recognize that if you're talking to an Orthodox Jew, they had high reverence for Moses. Well, then to point out the similarities between Moses and Jesus, because Deuteronomy 18 specifically says that this prophet that God will bring actually will be like Moses. And so he will be a leader, a prophet, a lawgiver, a deliverer, a teacher, a priest, an anointed one, a mediator, a human from God's chosen people. And interestingly enough, both of these books I mentioned have sections in that. So if you have a Jew, Orthodox Jewish friend that you're witnessing to, I would highly recommend the book. Tim LaHaye has a whole chapter on that. 12 different parallels between Moses and Jesus. And I'll let you read those. I just gave you a quick summary, but it would take an entire message just to go into those. And interestingly enough, D. James Kennedy, in his book, offers about 10 different parallels as well. So it's a very effective evangelistic opportunity if you're talking to your Jewish friends, neighbors, co-workers, to talk about, here's who Moses is, here's who Jesus is. Look at the interesting parallels. A couple of others, this is a timetable, we've talked about this before, and that is, it also gives a very specific idea of the timetable, and that is, it says in Malachi and in Psalms and Daniel 9, Zechariah 11, Haggai and others, which we've gone through some of the major and minor prophets within this last year, that the temple will be standing, that the Messiah will come into the temple. We've got to recognize there's some times when the temple did not exist. Can you think of some? Well, of course, when the Jews were taken into captivity, and of course the temple has not been standing since what? 70 AD. And so again, you can see how that is a very important timetable as well. And then in Daniel 9, we talked about this in previous classes. In Daniel 9, Daniel says, when will the Messiah come? And it says, well, there'll be 69 weeks or sevens of years from the time in which there is a decree to rebuild the wall in Jerusalem. And we know when that is, because that's the decree of Artaxerxes. It's actually recorded in Nehemiah 2. We know from secular history and from biblical history when that is. So here's when you start clicking. Okay, you start. And now you have 69 sevens of years, 483 years, or if you want to use the Jewish calendar, it's 173,880 days. So we start here, we count 173,880 days, then we look for the Messiah. That turns out to be April 33 AD. Anybody think of what's happening April 33 AD? That's when Jesus entered into Jerusalem, what we today call Palm Sunday. So if you're looking for the Messiah, here's the start, here's the end, and here's how it works out. Pretty specific. A couple more, it says that at that particular time, that he'd be riding a donkey, and Zechariah talks about that. I think it's interesting because once again, we see Jesus didn't come in riding a chariot. Didn't come to a place of influence, but it comes into Jerusalem, and we see the fulfillment of that in Matthew 21 and Luke 19. Then we have the betrayal of Jesus by a friend. We see that in Psalm 41 and the fulfillment. But more particularly, as we went through the book of Zechariah many months ago, we pointed out that in Zechariah 11, the betrayal is given some very specific statements. First of all, that the price of the betrayal will be 30 pieces of silver. The time when that was written, the common currency was gold, not silver, but silver. It would be cast on the floor of the temple, and it would be used to buy a potter's field. And Matthew 27 shows us that fulfillment. Then we have the trial of Jesus, where he's accused by false witnesses, and we see that, that the Messiah would not open his mouth to defend himself. We see that as well, that he would be beaten and spit upon. You know, there are some that try to say, well, maybe Jesus tried to make all these prophecies fulfilled, but how do you fulfill the actions of other individuals? Kind of difficult. Then it says that he would be numbered with transgressors. Isaiah 53 oftentimes we read at the Christmas season. Or we see, for example, he will divide the booty with the strong because he poured out himself to death. And he was numbered with the transgressors, yet he himself bore the sin of many. And of course, Matthew points out that that's a fulfillment where he was crucified between two thieves. Also, this idea of crucifixion is kind of interesting because in Psalm 22, it says that he was pierced for our transgressions. Zechariah talks about that as well. And you have to think about this because in Psalm 22, this was written almost 1,000 years before the crucifixion. What was the mode of execution at the time when that was written? Stoning, right? But the Sanhedrin no longer had the right to put people to death, so Jesus was crucified according to Roman law. And again, this may have been puzzling for some. Pierced through for our transgressions. What does that piercing mean? He would be stoned. It says he'd be buried with the rich. Isaiah 53, he's buried with the wicked, but in the rich of his death. Matthew 27 says that this was fulfilled in terms of being put in the tomb owned by Joseph of Arimathea. And finally, just before we run out of time here, prophecies of his victory. We've looked at prophecies of his coming, prophecies of his ministry, but let's look at the prophecies of his victory. And one of the most powerful ones, which we just referred to, is in Psalm 22. Psalm 22 starts with this phrase, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Where have we heard that? Those are the words from Jesus on the cross. It's as if Jesus say, this psalm, Psalm 22, applies to me. And first of all, we see that in Psalm 34, it says the Messiah's bones will not be broken. We see that fulfillment in John 19. It says that they will divide his clothing and cast lots. We see that in Psalm 22. And again, John 19 gives that fulfillment. That he will be given vinegar and gall to drink. And then also that he, indeed, Psalm 22 talks about his death at Calvary. Because in verse 8 it talks about mockery. Verse 13 it talks about shame. Verses 14 to 16 talk about pain. And then of course the one we just looked at, verse 18, talks about parting his garments. But interesting enough, you read through Psalm 22, at the end, even though it talks about these horrible things happening, it ends with this idea of at least hinting at the resurrection, that the suffering will lead to salvation. So again, if you were an Old Testament Jew, you'd be puzzled because you were expecting the Messiah to be a powerful individual. Well, those were the prophecies of his second coming. They sort of missed the first coming prophecies that said that he would be pierced, he would be mocked, he would be scourged, but in the midst of that, they would receive salvation. And then finally, we have, of course, the resurrection. In Psalm 16, it confirms that God would not leave the Holy One in hell, nor would his body see corruption. And it's interesting that Peter, in the book of Acts, actually when he is preaching in Jerusalem, refers back to that promise and says, his soul was not left in hell, neither did his flesh see corruption. And so we can see that there are 16 different categories, 333 different prophecies written down in the Old Testament that were literally fulfilled in the person of Jesus Christ. So during this Christmas season, I would certainly encourage all of us to take heart about what is happening and to recognize that we have a very firm foundation for our faith. For some of you that came in early, or late, I should say, earlier we talked about this book by D. James Kennedy called Messiah, Prophecies Fulfilled, and also a book by Tim LaHaye, Jesus. And these are books that I would highly recommend, especially during this Christmas season. Parker?